Welcome to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on this week's program, we hear about the 100-year-old stories of prostitution, gambling, and drinking in Lancaster in the Lancaster Vice Project. Also on the program, author Brad Wolf talks about his newly published book, A Ministry of Risk, that contains the writings of peace activist Philip Berrigan. The history that most of us have been taught or focus on usually centers around the people and events that shaped our nation, state, or the towns and cities that we live in. Often that history is full of dates, stories, and well-known names. Of course, right now, there are debates going on across the country about who and what should be included in that history. But what we don't hear as often is the seamier side of history. And every place has those stories they don't highlight in the history books. But those tales can tell us a lot about the place, its people, and how they evolved. That history can be fascinating and entertaining as well. A great example is the Lancaster Vice Project. Lancaster was known as a wide-open city in the early part of the 20th century, where prostitution, gambling, and drinking were rampant, and law enforcement sometimes looked the other way. The Lancaster Vice Project includes a walking tour, a podcast, a blog, and articles in LNP. Allison Kibler is a professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality at Franklin and Marshall College. Dr. Kibler runs the Lancaster Vice Project, and she's with us on The Spark today. Dr. Kibler, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. That's a great introduction to the project.
Well, I hope I didn't answer all the questions right there.
No, I think you did a great job of highlighting one of the underlying purposes of the project, which is to tell the stories of people who don't usually make it into history books or onto historical markers, like the people who are involved in vice in the early 20th century in Lancaster are, for the most part, you know, working class people who don't usually leave a record of like accomplishments that we think of as historically relevant. But that's, I hope to counter that.
Well, how did you get started on this project? I know you've been working on it for some time.
Yes. I first came to know about a tremendous historical resource in Lancaster because of a project a student did, I think about a decade ago. They wrote a paper that used the Law and Order Society collection at Lancaster History, which is just a few blocks from my office at F&M. And this archive is basically the records left behind by anti-vice investigators who came to Lancaster in 1913 to try to help some reformers in Lancaster put the lid on vice. And these reformers came and then worked undercover. They interview people throughout the city, bartenders, pool hall hustlers, waiters, sex workers, brothel keepers. Then the amazing thing that they do after that is they go back to their hotel rooms and they type up their notes. And those notes have been left behind. Almost 800, 900 pages of notes about their travels through the city. If those didn't exist, we wouldn't really know this history to the extent that we do, but they're an amazing, amazing set of records.
All right. So amazing. How would you describe them? And 800 pages, it almost sounds like a nonfiction book or even a fiction novel.
Oh, I say to myself many times, you couldn't really write better fiction than what they're writing. And in a way, sometimes it's helpful to think about it as fiction in a sense, because it is, sometimes it reads like a transcription of an event or a conversation, the things that they type up. But I don't think they can truly be that. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to me that they would have been in disguise as a traveling salesman, for example, and then have a notebook taking notes on what they, a conversation that they strike up with, you know, a woman on the corner downtown. But so the record that they leave is incredibly detailed, but also very one-sided and maybe deceptively detailed. But even though there's an undoubtedly bias in the accounts, they are they're a very interesting window onto the world of vice. You do get snippets, and sometimes more than snippets, about the history of people who are involved in commercial sex or gambling, what their goals and aspirations are, what some of their struggles have been. And those are the things that you would not otherwise get.
There may be people that have always thought, maybe still do think, that this couldn't happen in Lancaster. This conservative, religious community that has prostitution, gambling, drinking, how could that happen? Was there anything in those reports that maybe shocked you or surprised you?
Definitely. I mean, the extent of it is still surprising. Well, let me say two things. One is that Lancaster is not alone. So there are cities across the country, larger, sometimes smaller, that have basically the same set of political dynamics going on. So in Lancaster, the set of conditions that makes this happen is that there is a government that's running as a corrupt machine. And in Lancaster, that happens to be a Republican administration. In other cities, it's a Democratic machine. So police officers are political appointees. Factory inspectors are political appointees. There are stories of kind of vote buying. So in that context, Vice is running in basically with the full knowledge of city officials and police officers. And it's not just that they sometimes do nothing, they largely do nothing and then sometimes participate themselves. So Vice in Lancaster is not a secret. Maybe you could describe it as an open secret, but it's definitely running in cooperation with law enforcement in Lancaster.
So what's
here's some examples from the archives. There's reports in the newspaper that police officers basically don't even patrol the streets at night. They just go to the firehouse and go to sleep on their overnight shifts. And then there's also a report. Now, this has not been fully substantiated, but two newspapers do report that there seems to be prostitution actually running out of City Hall, so or the county courthouse, so that women are coming in the back door at all hours of the night. And when they report on that in the paper, they kind of jokingly refer to the courthouse. They're sarcastically, they call it the Temple of Justice. And then in that article, they also refer to like Republican gangsters who run the city. So there's, I guess, just to underscore the extent that this is widely endorsed, at least like implicitly, and it's really part of a political regime in Lancaster.
When was this?
It's going on at least through the late 19th century, through the Republican machine is voted out of office in the early 1920s. That doesn't mean that Vice ends in Lancaster, but there's kind of a new approach to it. And the fact that the Republican machine is voted out of office is partly due to the work of the anti-vice reformers, including the kind of led by the rector of St. James Episcopal Church, Reverend Twombly. And one way to think about the political struggles over vice is actually that the reformers who are speaking out against commercial sex, gambling, and drinking, they actually are doing that as part of a larger political agenda. Like, they are seeking political change from that Republican machine, and arguing against vice is a good way to do it. So it's part of a bigger political drama. And I try to think of it in terms of political struggle instead of like individual morality. And some people, I think, want to continue to think about, you know, sex and gambling and drinking as, you know, personal vices. But I think the story is most accurately understood as a political struggle and an economic struggle about, you know, how to economically survive.
Dr. Kibler, one of the things you mentioned right up front in the first article I read in LNP is that Lancaster was referred to or described as a wide open city. What does that mean?
It means that commercial sex, gambling, and alcohol were like widely available, really outside of any kind of police regulation. Well, I would say it's not that they're completely unregulated. Once in a while, there's police action against a particular brothel or against a bar or a pool hall that's open on Sunday. But it's very uneven, and it's basically the system allows vice to be widely accessible, you know, through the early 20th century for sure. The investigators that come to town in 1913, they come for a month and they work undercover. Three men, some who become quite famous in their careers, and then one woman is also here. Her name's Minerva Mullen. And their evidence that they collect as they work around the city undercover, they produce a report that is designed to kind of shock the community into acting against how widespread and open commercial sex is in Lancaster. And in their report, they say there's 190 professional women, that's the word they use, and there are 40 houses. That means a brothel or a furnished rooming house that's basically used for sex workers and their clients, like to rent by the hour or maybe overnight.
40.
This is larger than other comparable cities. And then they say, we're not really even confident that we've counted everything. So it seems like they're asserting, like, this is more widespread than in other comparable cities. And then they compare some of the brothels in Lancaster to ones that they know about in New York City and Philadelphia and say, you know, these seem like those brothels in the big cities, you know. So it's definitely something Lancaster is known for, and people travel to Lancaster for vice specifically.
Why, in fact, you mentioned the word travel, but is that one of the reasons? You quote a man who ran one of these brothels as saying one of the reasons that the brothels were so popular is because Lancaster had a lot of travelers.
Right. I think it's interesting, some of the geography of the commercial sex in Lancaster really does seem to focus on travel. So the hotels in Lancaster are very close to the old train station downtown, which is on the corner of Chestnut and Queen. And then if you just walk like one or two blocks up Queen Street, you're going to basically encounter the central commercial district of Lancaster, hotels, restaurants, theaters, like lowbrow and highbrow theaters, and pool halls, all of those commercial venues for nightlife that kind of would cater to travelers, they're also hubs for vice. Maybe the vice isn't exactly going to take place in those rooms. Sometimes there is a back room that sex workers would use, but they're places where you would find out where to go, where you would meet someone who is a sex worker or who is a category of young woman known as a charity girl. And they get a lot of attention in these reports. These investigators are very interested in the charity girl, otherwise known as the treating girl. And she was someone she usually worked a factory job during the day, or maybe they're a clerk in a candy store, in a department store. So they're out in the city by themselves, but they're not making very much money. And they want access to this nightlife, the movie theaters, the restaurants that they see downtown. So they start to exchange sexual favors for dates or sometimes for consumer goods. And those women appear very often in the investigators' reports, largely because the investigators are trying to talk them out of becoming like a full-time professional woman. So a lot of their dreams and struggles emerge in the reports. They're in a way more interested in them than they are in the women who are already working full time as prostitutes in brothels.
Who were the professionals, as they referred to them? I mean, what was the typical one like? And who were the charity girls?
Right. I mean, charity girls are sometimes they're high school girls in some cases. In other cases, they're women who are like working, they're wage earning single women. Some of them are living at home with their families. Other of them are living in rooming houses. But they're basically trying to make it economically as a single person without earning very much money. And also, they're kind of interested in the romance and adventure of the nightlife that's downtown. So there's dance halls, movie theaters, vaudeville theaters, and all of these things are kind of exciting for everyone, really. But also, if you have a job that's kind of drudgery during the day, you would especially be like looking for the respite and excitement of some of this nightlife. So they're there. They are out there on the streets. They kind of share the streets with the full-time sex workers. And they actually refer to each other sometimes, which is interesting. Sometimes you'll hear the voice of a full-time sex worker in the investigators' reports who says things like, you know, the charity girls are just kind of, they're giving it away for free. Like they're kind of ruining our business model, which is interesting. And the charity girls really want to protect their reputations in a sense. And they say, you know, I'm not anything like, you know, a full-time prostitute. But you can see the one woman whose story is very prominent in the investigators' reports is named Barbara Foreman. And she talks a lot about how she's struggling with some family tensions. She's working as a tobacco wrapper. She earns her wages through piecework, which, you know, means she's getting paid like per cigar, I think. And then she wants to leave Lancaster. She talks about her dreams of going to New York City and get out of her job here. And she talks to investigators about having a particular romance that's interesting to her. Maybe he's going to take her to New York City. And then at the same time, the investigators notice that she has a friend named Marie, that Marie seems to be already working as a sex worker, and that the brothel keeper at Marie's brothel is starting to try to recruit Barbara Foreman. So they spend a lot of time trying to encourage Barbara Foreman, like not to go with the brothel keeper whose name is May Snyder. And it seems unresolved at the end of their month-long investigation. It's not clear what's happened to Barbara Foreman, but in additional investigations that go on after those, after November of 1913, she does appear to have moved into May Snyder's brothel. Mm. So that drama of kind of what's going to happen to you as a single wage earning woman is part of the significance of the reports.
Well, there is drama in this as well. Now, I have to ask this question. I mentioned in the introduction that the Lancaster Vice Project includes a podcast, a blog, and an article in LNP, and there will be others, right, in LNP?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
But
a new one coming out soon, yeah.
Okay, walking tour. What would one see on a walking tour?
I know. Well, we do kind of look up and down the street that was once had the highest concentration of brothels. Even though Lancaster didn't have a single red light district, the highest concentration was on Water Street. But there's a wide variety from one end, from the north, from one end to the other. The red light district is not monolithic by any means. And one end of that red light district is racially integrated, which is, I think, a significant piece of the story, race. Because vice is racially integrated and in some ways more racially integrated than other aspects of Lancaster society at the time. So that's an important piece of the story, that the concentration of commercial sex in Lancaster overlaps with neighborhoods that are home to most of the Black population of Lancaster, immigrants and working class. Lancastrians. And that's usually deliberate, that these vice districts kind of get put in places that are impoverished and then kind of reinforce stigma about race and poverty.
So we're almost out of time. Your website has all this information. What is the website?
The website is LancasterVice, one word, .com. And that you can link to the podcasts there and sign up for a walking tour and read the blog.
Dr. Allison Kibler, thank you very much for being with us. So fascinating.
Thank you so much, Scott. I enjoyed it.
Coming up on the second half of the Spark Weekly, author Brad Wolf talks about his newly published book, A Ministry of Risk, that contains the writings of peace activist Philip Berrigan. You're listening to the Spark Weekly. I'm Scott Lamar.
Our next guest is author Brad Wolf, who authored the book A Ministry of Risk, which is a definitive collection of Philip Berrigan's writings authorized by the Berrigan family and is arranged chronologically. And these writings depict the transformation of one revolutionary soul, and critics have stated the A Ministry of Risk offers both a living manifesto of nonviolent resistance and a journal of spiritual reflection. And I'm happy to welcome its author, Brad Wolf, to The Spark today, who also happens to be a Lancaster Catholic grad. That means that you are in great company, my friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Likewise. Thank you for joining us. So first and foremost, can you tell us, why did you write this?
Philip Berrigan was somebody who fascinated me for a while because, as you said, I went to Catholic high school but was never taught about the Berrigans and didn't learn about Philip and Daniel Berrigan until years later. And then I discovered these Catholic priests who truly walked the walk. They were civil rights activists. They were anti-war activists. And they went to prison for long periods of time for nonviolent resistance to war. And Philip, in particular, spent 11 years in prison for nonviolent resistance to war. And he had this amazing evolution throughout his life, from World War II veteran to priest to civil rights activist and anti-war activist to political prisoner. And his writings are all out of print. All of his books are out of print. And I thought we really need to hear the work and the life story and the witness of Philip Berrigan today. And so I set about going to the archives in Cornell University and DePaul University and doing the research and compiling this book to get it out there to the public so we can learn and we can be motivated by Phil Berrigan.
So did your Catholic school background play a role in this? Because going through this, I'm like, wow, you know, we typically don't see, you know, priests in this kind of realm, so to speak.
We certainly don't. And that's what fascinated me and excited me about the work, because my Catholic background, you know, I was born and raised Catholic. And so it provided a backdrop and a context for me in the research of this book. And it gave me an idea of what Phil Berrigan was having to battle himself with the church. Because in the 1950s, as he's organizing and mobilizing groups for civil rights, and then in the 1960s, as he does that for the anti-war activities against Vietnam, the church is pushing back constantly, trying to silence him. And they're moving him from one diocese to another. He goes from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans, to Newburgh, New York, to Baltimore, to New York City. They keep trying to silence him because he's upsetting the church hierarchy and the white conservative parishioners. But Phil can't be silenced. He continued to write, to speak out, and to act. And so, you know, it was good for me to see, as a Catholic, people who were out there really living their faith in a day-to-day manner.
Yeah, and now he wasn't the only one. There was a group of them. So what was it specifically about Philip Berrigan that made you want to research and then make sure that his words are highlighted?
I really appreciated Phil's personality. I could relate to it. You know, he had this journey, as I mentioned, from soldier to priest to servant, and he didn't come across the way many peace activists come across. You know, Phil could be very sharp-elbowed. He could be assertive. He could be domineering. And he was very open about these problems, you know, these issues that he had. And I could relate to that kind of honesty and that kind of integrity. And so when I would read his journals, his handwritten journals, I was really impressed with how honestly he was open about his own failures and the work that he needed to do. So we have these legendary sort of mythical anti-war activists that we feel that we can't relate to. But Phil was somebody that I could relate to. And he kind of gives you the idea that we all play a role. We all have something we can do. We can all take up a ministry of risk of some kind and do something.
Yeah, and you said he was sharp-elbowed, making him a sharp-elbowed priest. That sounds like a Netflix movie. I'm not going to lie. Now, you did mention that he was a soldier as well. So, in your opinion, how did his experiences in World War II shape his later activism?
Deeply. It truly did. So he goes to World War II, and he writes in this book how he wanted to go to war, and he wanted to kill as many Nazis as he could. And he was a big guy. He was athletic. He was strong. He was bold and brave. And he referred to himself as Philip the Bold when he went to war, just this young whippersnapper who becomes the perfect killing machine. And then he comes home, and he reflects on the violence that he saw and that he participated in. And as he writes, he said, "I had to look into the mirror of my own violence and reconcile that with my faith." And so after a long period of discernment, he joins the Catholic order known as the Josephite Priests, which is a specific order dedicated to serving African Americans. And he chose that order because of the racism and discrimination he saw in basic training down south and also during his entire time in the armed services. So I think the war affected him deeply, and he began to realize that the United States, in its seeking of global hegemony and becoming this culture of militarism, was not all that different than other military empires in history, and he felt compelled to work against it.
Now, in your research, have you discovered that Berrigan experienced any kind of PTSD?
You know, I don't. Phil was of a generation that didn't talk too deeply about that kind of thing, right? Even in his journals, what was fascinating is prison journals, as I was going through them, most of us who keep a diary, our diary is about how we feel and what we did that day, and it's all about us. Phil's prison journals were all reflections he had on the other prisoners, his observations of the other prisoners, how he could relate to them and understand how the incarceral system was just another projection of the military-industrial complex. So whether he had PTSD from the war, I can't say. I can tell you that it deeply affected his life afterwards and guided him all the way up until his death in 2002. You know, on his deathbed, his last writing was that, "I die believing that nuclear weapons are the scourge of the earth and an offense against God."
So what are some of the key societal issues, some of the other key societal issues that Berrigan confronted during his lifetime?
This was a really fascinating part of the research. And, you know, I discovered that Phil was writing about, of course, civil rights and segregation first. And his first book in 1965 is called No More Strangers, and it's about race and segregation in America. And then he moves to the anti-war efforts, and he understands that racism and militarism are linked with materialism, those three evils that Dr. King spoke about. So his writings in this book talk about racism, they talk about militarism, but they go into this consumer culture that we have in the United States. He says Americans are brutalized by affluence. And what he means by that is we're desensitized by it, right? We're kept in a state of economic anxiety, where we always want the latest gadget and we're diverted with mindless entertainment. And we lose our humanity by doing that because we're shutting ourselves off to the suffering and the needless death that's going on, oftentimes, too often, perpetrated by the United States, mm-hmm. using our tax dollars and using the name of our country. So he gets into those items of consumerism and materialism. He also confronts environmentalism very early on. He recognizes that the ravages of war are destroying the environment and that the corporate state in America is destroying the environment for profit. So he writes a lot about the environment and the need to take care of the environment. Mm. So he kind of covers all of these bases over his years as you read these writings. And that was something that really astounded me.
It sounds like we could drop him right in the middle of 2024 right now, and a lot of his material would still be relevant. And mentioning that, those who are speaking like this in 2024 are receiving pushback from many different angles. So what kind of pushback did Berrigan witness speaking like this?
Intense pushback. You can only imagine in the 1950s and 1960s, the reaction of the American public and the church hierarchy to a Catholic priest who is the embodiment of middle-class conservatism going to prison and participating in actions such as pouring blood on draft files or using homemade napalm to burn draft files.
Wow.
And Phil chose those acts. He wanted them to be highly symbolic acts, because he wanted to stimulate conversation around the American dinner table. He felt that the Americans were in this period of somnambulance. They weren't paying attention, and he wanted to wake them up. So the image of a Catholic priest doing these things was part of it, but the pushback was intense. He was derided by the public, he was ostracized by his church, and he was sent to prison by his government.
Now,
his first action, I'm sorry.
No. Go on ahead, please continue.
You know, his first draft action in Baltimore in 1967, he and three others, known as the Baltimore Four, entered the Selective Service office and removed draft files, and they poured their blood on the files, symbolizing the spilt blood of Christ, but also symbolizing the spilt blood of innocent Vietnamese and Americans who were dying in that war. And for that act alone, he received a 6-year prison sentence.
Oh,
so that's the kind of pushback that you're looking at that he was willing to undertake. And before he could begin serving the sentence of those 6 years, he went out and organized another even bigger action in Catonsville, Maryland, where they poured the napalm on hundreds of draft file records. And what this did was spur a whole movement of draft file records being burned by other groups, because there were no copies kept of these draft files. So once they were destroyed, those men were not being conscripted to kill or be killed in Vietnam. So it had both symbolic effect and practical effect.
There's a book launch on April 21st, right, Brad?
That's correct. We're having a big book launch at April 21st, 1 o'clock. That's a Sunday. And it's going to be downtown Lancaster at Zotropolis Cinema. And they're located at 112 North Water Street. And this is really a special day because it's not just a book launch, but we're also premiering a documentary on the Berrigans. Mm. And the film is called Devout and Dangerous, and it's a wonderful movie that talks about Philip Berrigan, Daniel Berrigan, and Elizabeth McAllister. And so we're going to have the book launch, we're going to have the film, and then we're going to have a panel discussion. And joining us for the panel discussion is Freda Berrigan, who is Phil's daughter.
Wow.
And some of your listeners are going to wonder, how does a Catholic priest have a daughter? Well, we can get into that if you'd like, but the film also talks about that. He married Elizabeth McAllister, who was a nun, and they had a wonderful family. And so Freda is going to be present as part of that panel discussion to talk about what it was like to grow up Berrigan with parents who were going to prison for nonviolent resistance to war. So it should be a great day. And it's a free event. Please come down. Zotropolis Theater, April 21st at 1 o'clock.
Brad, I'm going to say this. Yes, I have many follow-up questions now because it sounds like a punchline. A priest and a nun get married. That sounds like the beginning of a joke. How?
Yeah, that's not something we learned at Lancaster Catholic High.
Right.
So what happened was Phil Berrigan met Elizabeth McAllister, who was a Catholic nun in the 1960s, because they were both active in the anti-war effort. They fell in love. And in 1969, shortly before Phil was to begin his prison sentence, they privately exchanged vows in a church. They saw their relationship and their marriage as a radical assertion of their faith and of nonviolence and of love. And so they did not tell anybody about this, did not tell the church about this. Of course, it's not permitted within the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And when it became public later on in 1970, 71, they were both excommunicated from the church.
Oh, wow.
And they then married officially with friends and family present. And then they had a wonderful family, three children, Frida, Jerry, and Kate. And they started a community house, much like a Catholic worker house in Baltimore called Jonah House in 1973. And this was this community house where people would live together in faith and nonviolent resistance. And all of these individuals that I've interviewed over the last couple of years lived there at one time or another, and their lives were changed by living there, you know, their commitment to peace and to nonviolence and to Dr. King's idea of trying to create the beloved community. This was integral to life at Jonah House. And so it's a fascinating story to read that part of Phil's life, too. He lived so many lives, you know, soldier, priest, and then husband, father, family man, community man. All of these things were going on in this amazing man's life.
And you mentioned MLK. Did he ever meet MLK? Because I certainly see the overlap here.
Never personally met him, though he and Daniel were at the March on Washington and they were at Selma marching and things like that. But no direct meeting that I could find between he and MLK. But Phil in his writings mentions other civil rights activists. Eldridge Cleaver, he's in prison at one point, and Phil remarks about reading Soul on Ice, the autobiography of Eldridge Cleaver, who, of course, was a famous Black Panther activist in the 1960s. And Phil was quite at home with these individuals, Malcolm X and other individuals like that. He saw that this system in the United States was intentionally built to repress a large segment of our population, the African-American community. And he felt that once you have tyranny on one part of your population, it becomes easier to impose tyranny on other countries abroad. Mm. And that was the connection he saw between racism at home and militarism abroad.
Now, you did mention at the top of the show that his writings aren't as prevalent as they were, and that's one of the inspirations behind this book. Why are his writings and pieces disappearing?
His brother Daniel was a prolific writer and a gifted poet. Daniel was a Jesuit priest. And so Daniel's writings are still in print. And Daniel was always considered to be the writer of the two brothers, while Phil was the organizer, the action man. But I disagreed with that. As I read Phil's books, they were out of print. And as I started to buy them and read them, I thought, Phil's an excellent writer. He's a different type of writer. But his insight and his directness and his ability to quickly analyze a problem and articulate it back in his writings is outstanding. So my goal was to put these writings out there again for the public and have us all be challenged by them and hopefully be convicted by them. And it was an interesting process I used in researching this book. As I go to the archives, I just photographed all of the documents with my iPhone, took pictures, hundreds and hundreds of pages, and so came home and then read those documents out loud into my laptop so I could begin the editing process. And reading Phil's writings out loud impacted me in a way I had not anticipated, because you have a certain ownership of words when you read them out loud. Mm. And I would often stop after reading them out loud and think, wow, that was very powerful. Am I up to that task? Or did I realize that insight before? And so I would encourage listeners, if they buy the book, read a couple of passages out loud and see what effect it has on them.
It definitely had a great effect on me. Now, with his writing and his writing style, when you were going through this book, did you want to mimic what he was doing, or just really highlight his strong points that he was making?
Both, right? I wanted to keep Phil's unique voice and vernacular in there. The editorial changes I made were to get rid of outdated terms and names and facts and things that were no longer relevant that people wouldn't understand. And then to organize it, as I said, in this chronological fashion, so it serves as a historical document of Phil's life and also the United States. So it was important to keep Phil's unique voice there, which is this direct, forceful, prophetic voice. But it was also important to be challenged by it in my own activist life. You know, I'm a coordinator of the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. Phil's work inspired me to do that kind of thing and also to work with Peace Action Network of Lancaster, which is an organization locally here that we have. So I think when people read the book, they're going to be inspired to go out and do something. And that's the goal, was to have hope and recognize that every single one of us can play some part, that we each can undertake our own ministry of risk.
Oh, Brad, I want to thank you for joining us on The Spark. This has been great. And before we head on out, what lessons can contemporary peace activists learn from Berrigan's life and work?
What Phil would always say to activists, especially new activists coming on, is don't get tired, right? Continue the work regardless of the outcomes. Try not to be too concerned with the results. You never know what beneficial effects your actions are going to have. So find out your strengths. They may be organizing, they may be writing, they may be public speaking, whatever, they're making music, whatever they may do, find out those strengths and use them and go forward. Speak the truth. Bear witness to the truth and not be too obsessed with the results of your actions. You're doing good work, and I think that's the most important message Phil would have.
You're doing good work. That gave me goosebumps. I appreciate that, Brad. So, again, before we head on out, what's happening on the 21st of April?
April 21st is the book launch for A Ministry of Risk. It's also a film documentary that we're going to premiere at Zotropolis Theater called Devout and Dangerous. It's free. It's at 1 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. So come on down, join us for a day of peace and nonviolence and our efforts to push back the darkness with the truth.
And for folks that are interested in buying the book, where can they go?
Everywhere books are sold, you can go to Amazon, you can go to bookshop.org, you can go to Barnes & Noble online, you can request your local bookseller to carry the book. It's published by Fordham University Press. You can go there and buy it as well. Again, and of course, it'll also be for sale on April 21st at the book launch.
Again, that is author Brad Wolf, who is the author of A Ministry of Risk. Brad, thanks again for joining us on The Spark.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for tuning in to The Spark Weekly. On behalf of Scott Lamar and myself and the rest of the Spark team, we want to thank you for tuning in and making us a part of your week. The best thing that you can do right now is like our Facebook page and join the conversation. Again, thank you for listening and have yourself a nice day.